This is Take Care, a health and wellness show produced by WRVO Public Media. Thanks for joining us. I'm Catherine Loper.
And I'm Jason Smith. One of the reasons we bring you Take Care is to help you be better informed when it comes to health and wellness, to share insights from the experts who know the latest science and policy behind trends and discoveries. We want to know why people think the Mediterranean diet could be a healthy choice, or what would happen if no one got a flu shot.
Frankly, health and wellness is a popular topic these days, and it's not just exercising and eating well, but being mindful of your mental and physical state. With increased interest comes some new ideas and new research to back them up, and some of those ideas can seem a little, well, extreme.
If you can picture health on a spectrum, today we're going to explore some ideas on the very edges of that spectrum. Things you might classify as extreme, like the idea of positive stress and the anti-diet movement. But first, a discussion on how far we can push the body, physically and mentally.
I gotta get out. Ever get another fight? I gotta get my eyes open. Head's ringing like a bell. Who tied those weights to my hands? Why is my heart pounding this way? Why can't I breathe properly? I feel as weak as a kitten. Well, 38 ain't 20. I should have known.
What is our limit?
If I can only get my hands out of me and push.
Researchers have been trying to answer that question for decades. Olympic athletes are one thing, but what about a mother in distress? We've all heard the stories about incredible feats of strength from otherwise average people. Is it adrenaline? Untapped, unrealized strength? Like most things, the answer is complicated. Joining us to discuss this topic is Alex Hutchinson, author of the book Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. Alex is also a journalist and was previously a middle-long-distance runner for the Canadian National Team. Thanks for being with us today, Alex.
Thanks, Catherine. I appreciate the interest.
So let's just start with the basics. What is endurance?
I spent several years thinking about that question, so I'll try and condense it here. The short answer is that it's really hard to make any definition of endurance that's tied to like whether you get enough oxygen or whether your muscles can work. And so the definition that I like to use is that it's the struggle to continue against a mounting desire to stop. And so that applies whether you're running a marathon or, you know, studying for an exam or whatever the case may be.
There are a couple different factors that go into that. So could you briefly explain the different views of endurance, the human machine, or the it's all in your head view of endurance?
Yeah, and I should say both of those are sort of oversimplified extremes that I use to illustrate it. But really in the 20th century, there was a lot of effort to understand the human body like a machine, to think about if we understand the workings of the engines and the fuel and all that, that we could understand the absolute limits to which a human could be driven just by plugging in the physiological parameters like your VO2 max and things like that that people may have heard of. But the truth is that that approach to endurance never really tells you who's going to win a race or how far you can push yourself. And so in the last decade or two, there's been a real interest in trying to understand the brain's role and understanding why it is that some people can push harder than others, or why that some days you can push yourself harder than other days. And the central point there in that view is that what matters really is how hard it feels. You stop when it gets too hard for you to tolerate. And so it's more important than what's going on in your body is how you perceive or react to what's going on in your body.
It seems from your research that it doesn't seem to be one or the other, but a combination of both. And you even say it's not a tidy choice between the two. So when it comes to both physical and mental endurance, do they operate on their own, or is one really more important than the other, or how do they operate in combination?
Yeah, I mean, I think you nailed it, that it's not one or the other. You can't win the Olympics with a tough mind and a body that's not ready. But conversely, you can't win the Olympics with the greatest body if you're not willing to push yourself and have that mental fortitude too. So it really is both, just like the nature or nurture debate in genetics. You can't have one without the other. Now, which is more important is an interesting question and kind of depends on the context. I think if you want to win the Olympics, it's mostly physical. There's a sort of very high bar you have to clear in terms of your physical talent and training before the mental factor comes in for that last 1%. For most of us, though, we're born in a given body, and you can't really radically alter your body from week to week, but you can change how hard you're able to push yourself or how deeply you dig. So I think on a personal level, the mental stuff is much more important. But when you're comparing yourself to other people, the physical becomes more important.
One of the things you talk about in Endure has to do with pacing, and it's not just based on how you feel at the moment. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
We all think that pacing is very, very simple, that you should just go if you're running a race, you should pace yourself as evenly as possible, and anything other than that indicates you've made a mistake. But if you actually look at how world record setters pace themselves, they have this distinctive pattern where they start out fast, settle into a steady pace, and then at the end of the race, they have this dramatic acceleration, which is just like 12-year-olds running a race for the first time. It's sort of a hardwired pattern that even the best runners do. And for some scientists, that's an indication that we're wired to hold back and save a little bit of reserve to make sure that we don't run out of energy prematurely and perhaps do ourselves damage. Even the greatest runners find that when the finish line approaches, and when their brain knows that the danger is going to be passed, they suddenly discover they have more energy left than they thought they did.
I think that's so interesting. Part of it is also about expectations. So if we were able to free ourselves from expectations, would we be able to perform better? And you talk about a distance runner who had part of her temporal cortex removed, and so her expectations were different. Can you talk a little bit about that?
There's a lot of ways in which your expectations can either spur you forward or hold you back. And, you know, I had a personal experience as a runner where I had a dramatic breakthrough because the timing given by the timekeeper was off. He kind of tricked me by accident into thinking I was having a really good race, and so I did. And so this ultra runner named Diane Van Deren is another really interesting example. She really only became an ultra runner after having brain surgery to deal with her epileptic seizures, which were getting more and more severe. And the surgery helped with her seizures, but it also left her with some deficits in terms of being able to keep track of time and place. So she had a lot of trouble figuring out how far she'd been running, how far she still had to run, where she was at a given place. And what's interesting is that apparently she only became a runner after that happened, and she became a champion ultra runner. And what some people think is that essentially when she's out running, because she doesn't have a good sense of time and place, the only question she can really ask herself is, can I keep going? Can I take the next step? Can I take the next 10 steps? Instead of worrying about, can I run another 50 miles or another 100 miles, which is sort of a paralyzing question that most of us would ask ourselves in that situation. The brain's desire to impose a cautious pacing pattern, it doesn't work for her because she's not really clear on how far she's come and how far she still has to go. And that's made her into one of the greatest ultra runners of her generation.
You did a ton of research on different examples of endurance and experiments, and you actually participated in one to see if brain endurance training really worked. What was that like?
Yeah, this was fascinating. I was at a conference, and a researcher said, I think I can make people faster at running a marathon just while they're sitting in their armchairs training their brains. And I thought, that sounds pretty cool. I'll try that and write an article about it. And so I spent 12 weeks doing this brain endurance training program. The idea is that when you run a marathon or do any other sustained activity, it's not just the physical fatigue you have to fight against. It's also the mental fatigue, the sort of effort of holding your finger as close as possible to the flame and not pulling it back, pushing yourself as hard as you can. And you can train that ability by doing these cognitively fatiguing computer tasks where you sit in front of a computer and tap buttons in response to what appears on the screen. And so I did that. And there's been research showing that this can work. And my number one conclusion was that this is phenomenally boring and really hard to sit in front of a computer for an hour at a time, 5 days a week, tapping at these buttons. So my experience was just anecdotal. I wasn't doing a study, so I don't know whether it worked. But I do know that even if it did, I would never sign up for that again.
Is our brain our worst enemy or our greatest advantage to endurance? There are many more people, I think, who have brain endurance versus physical endurance, in my opinion. But can those of us who aren't long-distance runners use the theory that if we can take our brain endurance and apply it to physical endurance, we can get a little farther in our daily workouts?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't want to be saying, look, it's all in your head and you can do anything you believe you can achieve. That's pushing it a little too far because the physical does matter. But I do think understanding that when you run into a physical, what feels like a physical limit, it feels totally non-negotiable. It feels like, oh, well, my legs simply can't go any farther than this. And the truth is that almost always in situations like that, that feeling is an illusion, that it's your brain, it's an orange light, it's a caution light saying you should stop. It's not a red light saying you have to stop. And so gradually you can learn to push those limits back if you're aware that these limits are not bumping into a sort of ironclad physical limit. And you can get better at sort of pushing a little farther each time, using that mental endurance that you may have in other aspects of your life to push a little harder and a little farther in the physical realm.
And one of the modern day understandings of endurance is the marathoner. Can you talk a little bit about how Nike's breaking 2 Project Factor into your understanding of endurance and the limits of the human body? That's the under 2 hour marathon project.
Yeah, you know, they spent years and tens of millions of dollars trying to engineer the fastest possible marathon. And I was covering it for Runner's World for about 6 months. And so I wrote a ton of articles about all the technology they were using, the new shoe technology and the way they were setting up drafting to reduce aerodynamic drag and all these sorts of things. But at the end of the project, what I came away with was that I thought that the success of the project, which was that a Kenyan runner named Eliud Kipchoge came very close to 2 hours. He ran 2 flat, 0 minutes and 25 seconds. The success was in some ways due to Kipchoge's remarkable mental strength, that his ability to push himself and to build his own confidence in his abilities was really the distinguishing factor. And so once he had done that and proven to himself that he could run close to 2 hours, it wasn't surprising to me that in September of this year, he ran a huge world record, slicing more than a minute off the existing world record. So I think there's a real important lesson there about his ability to create belief that he could go faster than anyone else had before and how that translated into a world record.
Well, thanks for sharing your research into this topic of endurance and joining us here on Take Care, Alex.
Thanks so much, Catherine. I really appreciate it.
That was Alex Hutchinson, journalist, runner, and author of the book Endure. You can find his work in Outside Magazine, The New York Times, The New Yorker, and other publications.
There's another topic in the health and wellness community that isn't always clear-cut: weight loss.
All right, all right. Anyhow, it isn't your weight I'm concerned about. It's your wife's.
Molly, What's wrong with her? She's okay, isn't she?
Sure, she's in fine health. The only thing is, it would be an excellent idea if she'd take off about 10 pounds.
You ought to take off about 10 pounds off your fat head, fathead. Molly's perfect the way she is, and you know it.
The only trouble is, I hate to come right out and ask her to go on a diet.
Whether the issue is that you've hit a plateau or that you're stuck in a cycle of weight loss and weight gain, it's not always easy to get the results you're looking for or to do it in a healthy way.
We're not just talking about quick fixes or miracle pills. Sometimes your mental state can have a lot to do with your weight. And some would argue that the concept of dieting is not something that encourages a healthy relationship with your own body, so much so that some are now joining the anti-diet movement. Our next guest is Samantha Cassidy, a registered dietitian nutritionist and contributing nutritionist for NBC News Better. Thanks for being with us on Take Care, Samantha.
Thanks so much for having me today.
I was unaware of something called the anti-diet movement. Can you describe what that is?
Yeah, this is a type of practice often used by registered dietitians, and it takes a intuitive eating approach to, I would say, health and nutrition, and removes weight from the conversation. So it's not about dieting or restricting behaviors, but more about learning how to eat intuitively as a way to support your health and wellness goals.
Now, you write that you don't necessarily agree with that diets don't work idea. So can you tell us a little bit about why?
Yeah. So first of all, I believe that there are a variety of different styles that people can practice, and they support different people's goals. But then I also believe that weight loss can be a very productive form of self-care for people who are overweight and are feeling crummy about how they feel in their bodies. And I don't think that some of the principles of intuitive eating, which involve self-care and removing some of the negative chatter in our heads that we often use to judge ourselves after eating unhealthfully, moving in ways that are enjoyable to you rather than punitive or as a way to burn calories. I think these are amazing principles, and I also think that they can align with the practice of trying to eat better to support a healthier weight.
So the idea behind intuitive eating is, you know, listening to your body and sort of giving it what it needs. But there's also that mental side to it. And if, you know, I may think my body is telling me I'm hungry because my husband just bought donuts and they're sitting there on the table, when really it's just my mental desires for that donut.
Right. And the truth is, we're never going to get this 100% right. I think it's unrealistic for anybody to think that they're never going to reach for a donut when the mood strikes rather than when they're just purely physically hungry. We do need to identify our physical hungers and tune into what our body tells us, not only just about when it's full, but when it feels its best. So I think it's really important to develop better listening skills to what your body is trying to say. But I also think, you know, we don't sit down to a plate of calories or a bowl full of fiber. We eat for a variety of reasons, and some of that is just pure pleasure. And I think it's unrealistic for anyone to expect that that's never going to happen.
And dieting, for some people, we do have an obesity epidemic in this country. It can provide health benefits by even just losing 10 pounds or a small percentage of one's body weight, right?
That's correct. So what the evidence really firmly points to is that if you lose just 5% of your body weight, which is actually less than 10 pounds for the average woman, that you would get significant health benefits from that. And that's not to say that it would always be an easy pursuit. You know, losing weight can be very challenging for people, but I think that it's also can be a very self-loving act, and that eating well is an act of self-care.
Is part of the anti-diet movement is because so many of us have been involved in years of yo-yo dieting where you diet for a while and then, you know, you maintain it for a while, but then you gain it back and then you start the cycle again.
Yes, I think that's definitely sort of what's driving some of the momentum is that there's been this cycle of dieting. And then also, you know, realistically, I think especially women get judged for body size, professionally, personally, that there's a stigma against overweight people that has been shown in studies. So I do think that the beauty of the anti-diet movement is that it's weight inclusive and supports people being healthy and the idea that bodies do come in all different shapes and sizes and promotes sort of trying to feel compassion toward yourself and love for yourself. And that opens up a whole new realm of wellness that I think has been overlooked.
So what are ways to make conscious choices in your diet that still preserves your values of self-care?
I think one of the key things is to talk about what foods to include more of. For example, fruits and vegetables, and help people discover ways that they can enjoy those foods more often. Ideally, you'd want somebody to be eating about 3 servings of vegetables and 2 servings of fruit per day. So helping people discover ways to include those more often. And there's a big gap there. So 1 in 10 Americans are achieving those levels. I would also say reducing our reliance on overly processed foods. So certainly we need convenience in our lives. Multiple studies point to the fact that hyper-processed foods like overly refined grains and sugary foods and things like that do promote overweight and obesity.
And just finally, I think you have a theory that might be helpful to some people that healthcare professionals should be the cheerleaders and we should be our own quarterbacks when it comes to losing weight. Can you just tell us briefly what that concept is like?
So as a healthcare provider, I don't bring up a weight conversation with anybody. I believe I am the cheerleader and you as the client would be the quarterback. You are the boss of your own body. And so it's up to you to take that conversation where you want. And it's up to me to cheer you on with tips and ideas and help you along the lines of behavior changes. But it's also my job to maybe move the goalposts a little bit. So what I see a lot with clients is they'll have weight loss as a goal and they'll put a marker in the sand. And maybe that marker isn't realistic. And what I say to people is, I want you to live your healthiest and happiest life. But I do try to provide the support, encouragement, tools, tips, and advice to help them move in that direction.
Well, it's fascinating and a never-ending topic that we really appreciate you weighing in on. Thanks so much for joining us, Samantha.
All right. Thank you.
Samantha Cassidy is a registered dietitian nutritionist. You can read more of her work at NBCNews.com.
When we come back from the break, would you ride a roller coaster every year or spend more time in colder outdoor weather if you thought it would help you live better and longer? You're listening to Take Care.
Remember Weeble Wobbles? They were these little egg-shaped toys. You know, Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. No matter how hard you push them, they always made it back to their midpoint.
In our next guest's TED Talk, he referenced Weeble wobbles as a way to describe the way we age. He says it gets harder and harder for us to reach that stable midpoint again to recover, that our wobble essentially shrinks with age, whether we'd care to admit it or not.
Well, you see,
You had a headache, didn't you? How long have you had these headaches?
Oh, I don't have them.
You have one now?
No, I have not.
How did you come out at bridge yesterday?
Well, let me
quickly.
Think. I don't remember.
You've been losing a lot lately, haven't you?
Why do you ask me these stupid questions? There's nothing wrong with me. I'm well, absolutely well. I'm young and strong and nothing can touch me.
If you're wondering why you don't remember things as well as you used to, can't eat a greasy meal, or find even the idea of hopping on a roller coaster nauseating, stay with us. Dr. Jun Yoon is a physician and the president and managing partner of Palo Alto Investors. His goal? Finding new ways to stave off the effects of aging to increase our functional longevity. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So we came across your work while reading about the positive stress movement. Turns out there's a number of people, usually in high stress, demanding jobs, who are exposing themselves to things that are extreme, like extreme temperatures, restrictive diets, grueling exercise routines, and general discomfort because they believe it helps them perform better for longer. Is there any truth behind this premise?
Well, we don't know yet, but it certainly is an interesting and provocative concept. And it's in line with what I've personally observed as a physician and as an investor in healthcare as to what happens during the aging process. You know, when we're young, what we have is this incredible recovery function. We have bioresilience, I guess is the technical way to say it. We don't realize what we have until we start losing it right around 40. And all of a sudden, we start to notice that our ability to recover from things really starts declining precipitously. Even something as simple as recovering from a roller coaster ride. But same thing applies to recovering from a jet lag, a late night hangover, broken bone. You know, I broke two bones in my hand at age 43. I played hockey my whole life, and I'd never broken a bone. And I broke these two bones. I asked my hand surgeon, how long will it take for it to heal? And he didn't look at my hand. He looked at me, and he said about 2 years. So I think what he was saying is aging is the most important factor in our ability to recover. So if these are the things that we experience after 40, what about the things that we can't sense, such as our blood pressure and our glucose levels? You know, when we're young, those things are wobbling all the time, but they always get back to center. It always recovers. And then after 40, in some of us, these things don't recover, and we give it names like diabetes and hypertension. So it's unlikely that all these seemingly unrelated functions are being caused by different things. It's probably being caused actually by a common thing. The ability to recover is what appears to be disappearing after 40. So the question is, what can we do to recover our ability to recover? It works for about 40 years. That's the greatest healthcare system ever invented. It's the one that nature gave us. It leaves us around age 40, and then we create this healthcare system around you to help you recover. But inexorably, your own ability is declining. And in some ways, the way the medical system treats our recovery causes our body's own abilities to atrophy. The more we give people blood pressure lowering drugs, the higher our baseline. So it's almost like a drug addiction model. Is there a different way to strengthen our body? Maintaining high degrees of resilience and high degrees of recovery function may be what we need to sustain health beyond age 40 and beyond. And if doing so can reduce our mortality rates, having low mortality rates is the best way to promote longevity. I know it sounds funny, but not dying is the best way to live long. So if we can maintain high levels of recovery function, how long could humans live? I don't know the answer to your question. The theory here is, can we actually tap into our own ability to recover, strengthen that recovery function as a way to sustain health, rather than relying on the medical system or relying on drugs? It's like kind of exercising all of your physiologic systems. You know, the best way to lower blood pressure is to raise it through exercise. The best way to lower our baseline heart rate is to keep raising it with exercise. It's almost like immunizing or vaccinating against high blood pressure or high heart rate.
Could you explain the concept of functional longevity?
There's various different ways to think about longevity. And people ask me, are you trying to promote longevity? I'm like, no. That's known as the current healthcare system. The current healthcare system is doing a good job of increasing the quantity and quality of life. But we're not actually solving aging, so we're essentially creating an older population that needs more healthcare. It's almost like the output of the healthcare system is a geriatric population that needs more healthcare. So that's like a self-feeding beast as a system. So as good as the current system is, I don't think this is the right path. Why don't we actually try to figure out how to sustain health, sustain our functions? Some people call it health span, but health span is a vague term. What we lose as we age is our functions. And so what we're trying to see through science and research is to see if we can recover functions as we age. So think about things we lose as we age. We lose our memory, we lose our vision, we lose our hearing, we lose our tolerance to altitude change, to temperature change, our ability to balance, our recovery from an injury. These are the functional losses. So by pursuing functional longevity, we're asking the scientific system to help reverse functional loss. So not only are we living long, but we're maintaining high levels of function. And function is a word that the public can identify with, but it's also a word that scientists can identify with. So that ended up being a cleaner way to describe what our Palo Alto Prize initiative is and what our National Academy of Medicine initiative is.
What can we do today to start to increase our dynamic range?
First of all, on the science end, all of this needs to be empirically validated. So we're helping underwrite the first clinical trial that's ever been done to really test this idea. So all this needs empirical validation. Now, in the meantime, people can use their intuitions to see if they can continue to change up their human experience in every dimension. You know, spend more time in the sun, more time in the darkness, more time in the mountains, eating different kind of foods. You know, really ranging the experience both intellectually, mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually, as a way to build your own capacity to be healthy rather than a dependency. And none of these things are unfun things. These are all things that we'd want to do, and they're fun. So the gateway to functional longevity is actually to have more fun.
It sounds like a great prescription. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Yoon.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Jun Yoon is a physician and the president and managing partner of Palo Alto Investors. He's also creator and sponsor of the Palo Alto Longevity Prize, launched in 2014.
When it comes to modern healthcare, many see a system that's far from perfect. A lot of people aren't happy with their health insurance choices or the way we deliver healthcare or make decisions for our collective future. In some places, the healthcare system itself is being adjusted or reimagined altogether.
On-site company health clinics have been around for decades. If you bring the doctor right to the patient, suddenly healthcare becomes a lot more convenient. But some new care plans are taking that a step further.
Say you work for J. Smith Mechanical and your boss decides to contract directly with a healthcare system. You'll go to Loper Hospital for all of your health care from now on, and instead of your boss paying for your insurance premiums, maybe he offers the hospital a lump sum for their services per patient.
Or taking it a little further, maybe your boss at J. Smith Mechanical changes his mind. Instead, he'll pay Livonia Patient Care an agreed-upon amount to treat all of his employees. And Livonia Patient Care can focus only on the employees, is paid monthly by the employer, and cuts insurance out completely.
These different healthcare models are in practice across the country. In some cases, companies hire a healthcare provider to treat their employees, and other times, this relationship works on a fee-per-employee basis, kind of like a gym membership. Our next guest, Carolyn Engelhard, has an explanation.
Direct primary care is a new model, fairly new model, whereby primary care physicians kind of cut themselves off from the medical system with regard to typical ways we reimburse physicians. So if I am your physician, you pay me $50 a month, $100 a month. For that monthly fee, you get a certain number of office visits, maybe some labs, maybe an x-ray if I have an x-ray machine in my office, maybe texts and email communication. I, as your physician, have no overhead other than my rent and electricity and things like that because I have no official relationship with an insurance company, so I don't bill. And primary care physicians like it because typically they reduce their panel size by 2/3. And you can be an employer who might contract with a direct primary care physician or group of physicians in the community, and you send your employees there for primary care. A direct contracting model could be something very different. It might be a health system that operates traditional ways by either billing through a fee-for-service mechanism or maybe even being an HMO, which has a prepayment system. But the difference is it doesn't carve itself out of a traditional health system. It's part of a bigger system that just puts a primary care clinic as part of their larger system at the worksite.
Carolyn Engelhardt is director of the Health Policy Program in the Department of Public Health Sciences at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. We spoke to her about the goal of these healthcare models and where they fall short. Thank you for your time today, Carolyn.
You're very welcome.
So for some people, their yearly checkup could be as easy as going downstairs on their lunch break. Some companies are starting to offer in-house clinics that are providing primary and preventive care. Some other companies have contracted directly with a healthcare system or are experimenting with direct primary care. Now, before we get into the particulars, do you see this as the start of a transition from a fee-for-service model more toward a value-based care model?
Well, yes. I mean, these are very loaded terms. I do think that a general movement toward value-based care is coming. It has to come. Study after study after study tells us that there are inherent incentives in our healthcare system that push physicians to do too much, patients to want low-value care, and the price of goods and services makes the United States 2.5 times more expensive than any other industrialized nation, and our outcomes are no better. So yes, this is coming. We've been trying it with the Medicare population, with accountable care organizations. Has not saved a lot of money, has improved some quality, so it needs to be tweaked. It is the future, but how that term, value-based care, manifests in different populations, different cohorts, working age people, retired people, all of those things make a difference. And so, yes, the trend is there, but how it manifests matters.
So these providers, they sort of have to predict how much each patient is going to cost them, right? What do they do if they're wrong?
My guess is they just don't provide as much care.
Yeah, and that kind of approach, while it's still relatively new, do we know of any examples where direct primary care is working well or it's been tried and it hasn't worked?
Yes. I think most of the evidence about how well it's working is anecdotal. I understand the in-the-trench problems that comes with providing primary care medicine. Our reimbursement system today just does not appreciate primary care. And as a result, you get primary care docs that just have to churn patients through, and it's very unsatisfying for both the physicians and the patients. However, I have some real problems with the direct primary care approach for a variety of reasons. The first is that if you reduce the panel size by 2/3, that means that there are lots of patients in your community that you used to serve that you may not be serving anymore, and they've got to find another doctor who probably is already as overworked as you used to be. So it exacerbates the primary care shortage. The second problem I have with it is that by not taking insurance and by not being part of a larger health system, in a way, there's nobody measuring quality outcomes. I mean, we all like to think that every doctor is wonderful, but I can tell you, as someone who has worked and studied health policy for 30 years, that just isn't the case. And there are reasons why large payers like Medicare and large insurance companies and even employer groups now are requiring physicians to meet performance metrics. And so I have a problem with that, and I think it's going backwards in our healthcare system by sort of letting people be cowboys and cowgirls out there. There is evidence from Seattle. There was a huge direct primary care group called Q-Liance. They were the promoters of direct primary care, and in fact, people working with them were the movers and the shakers that got DPC as an acceptable option under the Affordable Care Act, as long as it was combined with a high deductible health plan. And Q-Liance spread very quickly and grew very quickly and actually went under contract with the Medicaid agency to provide primary care for Medicaid recipients so that they would use the emergency room less, they would have better health, and so on. And after, I believe, a year, Medicaid canceled their contract. And the reason they did doesn't necessarily mean Q-Liance was bad or direct primary care was bad in and of itself, but what we know about preventive care in healthcare is that most of the time people get better on their own, and it takes a very long time for preventive care to pay off. It's going to take a long time to see return on investment.
Well, thank you for your time today.
You're welcome. I hope it was helpful.
Carolyn Engelhardt is director of the Health Policy Program in the Department of Public Health Sciences at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. She co-authored the book Healthcare Half-Truths, Too Many Myths, Not Enough Reality.
As we continue to explore extremes in health and wellness, we head to a neighborhood in upstate New York where not every family starts off on the right foot.
How do you help mothers and babies in need, one door at a time? WBFO's Avery Schneider has the story of how one local Buffalo agency does it.
It's mid-afternoon in the office of the Buffalo Prenatal Perinatal Network, a more than 30-year-old not-for-profit focused on improving outcomes for babies and mothers. There are a number of ways they do it, but one of the most effective is with good old-fashioned footwork.
So we're going door-to-door looking for the clients that haven't accessed care yet for whatever reason. If there's stigma, if they just don't know where to go, they're worried about going. We try to find those cases that are scared or need shelter or whatever that aren't in the system yet.
Sherelle McLean is the care coordinator for a team of about a dozen community health workers, CHWs for short. Nearly every week, they hit the streets visiting sites picked by CHW program manager Marixa Sanchez.
So tell me about this neighborhood today, 14215, right?
Yep. We have a lot of teenagers. It's the lowest literacy rate in Buffalo, mm-hmm. and it has high infant mortality and high low birth weights. So this is a great neighborhood to seek out a lot of individuals, and there's a big population of teens.
As recent as 2016, the rate of infant mortality in this East Side neighborhood was more than 13 deaths for every 1,000 babies born, and low birth weight was a staggering 13%. It's among the city's worst outcomes, nearly double the county average, and a long way away from nationally set goals for 2020. UBMD epidemiologist Jim Shelton analyzes this data for all of Western New York. He says what drives 14215's long-standing statistics are the social determinants of health.
You know, which takes in place, you know, your housing conditions, economic conditions, you know, living conditions, education conditions, and that's just one of the poorer sections of town.
Sanchez says statistics tell her one in every six girls here will get pregnant. Most of the clients they find are Black or Hispanic, ages 18 to 23.
We're going to start off the block over here.
Sporting gray and maroon T-shirts and aprons, the CHWs are a visible presence in the neighborhood. They walk briskly from door to door, in and out of shops, even stopping people on the sidewalk for their key question. But not all interactions are like this. Finding someone who knows a pregnant woman or a new mother is somewhat common, but finding the woman herself can be rare. On this particular day, the team gets lucky when a resident points them towards Ariana Wardlaw. She had given birth only 15 days before to a baby girl named Journey, and it's her second child.
They're coming out here offering free services to help people in the community. What does that mean to you?
It's appreciative, because some people don't do it, so it's nice.
What kind of services do you look for now that you have a new baby?
Whatever I can get.
What's most important to you?
My kids. Yeah.
After an initial interaction, one of the CHWs circles back for a mini-needs assessment to find out what items Wardlaw might need as soon as the next day.
So this is what we're looking for. So, you know, her being homeless, she says she doesn't have food, and she needs other services.
Within the week, another CHW will be back to find Wardlaw for a full assessment and bring her on board as a client of the network. They'll make sure she gets insurance, a doctor for her and her baby, and even take them to their visits to help advocate. And that's just the beginning. Mothers can stay in the program until their child turns two. By that time, CHWs will help make sure they're in better housing, working or going back to school, and in general, living a better life.
that's what we do this for, to find that person, that individual. So I'm happy right now. I said I'm happy right now because this effort, even if we have one person again, that's great that we did that.
It's hard work helping change a community one door, one person at a time. But after 23 years in charge of this outreach program, Sanchez and her team are not giving up. Avery Schneider, WBFO News.
You can find out more about these resources on the Buffalo Prenatal Perinatal Network's website, bppn.org.
For the latest in health, we start with a new algorithm that could improve the diagnosis of rare diseases.
Rare diseases can be marked by a genetic mutation, but when it comes to diagnosis, finding that gene and ruling out others could take clinicians hours, potentially an entire week of work. But a team of researchers at Stanford is trying to change that.
Gil Bejarano is an associate professor at the Stanford School of Medicine. Earlier this year, in a paper published in Genetics in Medicine, his team revealed an algorithm that could improve our ability to diagnose rare diseases.
Just imagine for a minute that you're a doctor. You have a patient and are suspicious that they may have a rare disease with an underlying genetic cause. If you were, in fact, a doctor, you might send their genetic code out for sequencing to find the problematic gene.
You send them out to sequencing. The sequencing comes back. You analyze it very carefully. And then you're faced with, let's say, 200 genes, any one of which could have caused a person's disease. And then what currently happens is there are medical professionals, clinicians, who sit down and essentially go gene by gene over these 200 in the hope of finding the one gene that can explain the patient's disease.
The process, as our guest describes it, is arduous and expensive.
So our basic observation behind this work is saying, look, you know, clinician time is expensive, computer time is cheap. Why don't we get the computer to do absolutely as much as it can before the clinician comes on the scene?
One key thing to note here is that they're not interested in replacing the clinician, but setting them up on better footing to make decisions that only a human can. Does this person have this particular rare disease, and is this the gene mutation that caused it?
So the idea is that when the clinician shows up on the scene, they go down the list the way the computer organized the list for them, and hopefully immediately at the first gene, they just look at it and say, yep, the algorithm was right, this is the diagnosis. And if they don't, they go down to the second gene, et cetera. So the whole premise there is make clinicians work more efficient by doing as much as possible with the computer before the clinician starts to look at the case.
The algorithm is combing through a lot of information to make these lists. The patient's genes and phenotypes, essentially the signs and symptoms the patient is experiencing, and finally, a body of peer-reviewed papers.
You conceptually go to a body of all peer-reviewed papers that were ever published, and there are about 26 million of those, and you try to assemble a database of all genes and which phenotypes they may be causing through different diseases.
Their database includes information about which genes cause which diseases and what the symptoms are. That's the information the algorithm combs through, trying to compare them to what the patient's actual concerns are and to their genetic code.
The algorithm is called FRANK, by the way, with a PH for phenotype combined with the word rank. Bejarano says it is a work in progress, as are many algorithms.
We want to see as many patients as possible that have already been diagnosed. So this is something where, you know, we have this interesting conversation with the healthcare system because they naively would say, dude, really diagnose them. What do you care? And we say, no. It's the cases you diagnose that I need to train my system. You know, I want my system to put the causal gene that you found at the top.
The 5,000 rare diseases in Frank's database are all caused by mutations to a single gene and have no environmental component. If you have that mutation in your genome, you'll get the disease, but Bejarano sees the possibility for expansion from there.
We're going to start in rare diseases, build this wonderful semi-automated systems that help the clinician deal with a flood of data, and then expand from rare diseases into the more common ones as our understanding of the common diseases improves. Because right now, common diseases are somewhat mysterious in their underlying genomics. There is so many combinations of different genes that seem to be slightly messed up, but only in a tiny way, and somehow together they cause a lot of our more common diseases, that I think we need to improve our genomic understanding of common diseases before an approach like FRANK could be fully used there. But we and the community at large are making headways in those respects as well. So it's a wonderful beachhead into tackling all of medicine that has an underlying genetic component.
You can find out more about Frank, the algorithm, and research out of Bejarano's lab online at med.stanford.edu. The study we discussed is found in Genetics and Medicine.
Sticking with technology, our next conversation is with Catherine Schwab, an associate editor at Fast Company, who covers technology, design, and culture. We spoke with her because of her recent experience at what some are calling the health lab of the future. Thanks for being with us, Catherine.
Thanks so much for having me.
You visited Mount Sinai's Lab 100. That's an experimental clinic that's a collaboration between Mount Sinai and a design studio known for mixing digital tech with physical architecture. Can you tell us a little bit about the lab?
Sure. So Lab 100 is a really interesting space. It's kind of hidden in the corner of Mount Sinai's medical school library. And you walk in and it feels like you're in the future. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. It's so far away from a regular doctor's visit. And the goal with the lab is to help healthy people understand what the baseline of their health is. And so the lab's goal is to try and connect lifestyle choices that people are making when it comes to diet, exercise, etc., to actual health metrics that can be tracked over time.
So this lab focuses on healthy people rather than the traditional model of you go to the doctor when you're sick. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the differences that you saw in this lab as opposed to, say, going to a traditional doctor's office?
Yeah, they do a ton of different tests that are much more extensive than anything you'd get at the doctor's office. Probably the most interesting, there was a balance test, which I have never done before. They had me stand on a foam pad with my eyes closed and my arms crossed over my chest.
When you're going through these tests, did they tell you the purpose of these tests? I mean, obviously, these are things that you don't experience at a normal doctor's office. So what would a balance test, how would that explain your overall health?
They did explain everything as I was going through, and I was also asking a ton of questions. I think the balance test is the best example of this because Dr. David Stark, who started the lab and runs the lab, he took me through everything. And he said, you know, we don't test for this and we only find out when you have a fall for the first time. And that, you know, that fall, he said, could land you in the hospital with a hip fracture. So if you know that your balance isn't great and once you have that information, you can actively work on it.
So if one of the goals of this lab and these tests is to sort of break down your health information and maybe try to push you to make certain adjustments, like with your balance, in your experience, did you find that this kind of changed your ideas about health?
Yeah, you know, I really enjoyed my experience there. I don't think I would have ever gone of my own accord because we're so not used to thinking about health in this way. I'm healthy, I'm young, I exercise, why do I need to go to the doctor? But seeing everything kind of laid out in front of me helped me kind of make some connections that I probably wouldn't have made otherwise. I actually think, for me, the biggest change came from one of the surveys that I did before arriving at Lab 100. So that's how they help assess your diet, exercise, those kinds of things. So those are still self-reported. But one of the hardest things for me to input into one of the surveys was how much I sit every day. And when I really thought about that question, how much do I sit every day? And I think my answer was something like 8 to 10 hours at least. Physically inputting that into the computer system was very difficult for me. And that piece of information, just that feeling that I got that, oh, you know what, I don't want to be this sedentary, that has helped me use a standing desk at work.
You wrote in your article that you had to give consent from Mount Sinai to use your anonymous lab results in other studies. Do you know
Yes.
what makes it into their data bank of sorts?
The data that they collect during Lab 100 basically all goes into a database in a de-identified manner, from my understanding. And you can either consent to have them use that data in other studies or not. Ideally, for them, these are long-term studies where if they have enough people who go through Lab 100 and then they have people come back periodically, they can kind of track how people's lifestyle changes impact their health over time. So that's one of the main goals of the lab is to you know, understand those trends more long-term. Though that's going to take obviously a lot of time. I mean, this opened just in the last year, so they've got a long way to go before they get to that point, but that is one of the goals.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great conversation.
Catherine Schwab is an associate editor at Fast Company. She joined us to talk about her experience at Mount Sinai's Lab 100.
That's it for Extremes, at least this time. We know there's more interesting health and wellness news out there, so if you have any ideas, comments, or questions, email us at takecare@wrvo.org or find us on social media. You can find more about all of the topics we covered today at wrvo.org. Listen to our conversations there or on iTunes, where you'll find the Take Care podcast.
The Take Care team here at WRVO Public Media includes myself and Catherine, as well as Leah Landry, who does most of the research on our topics and guests, and Mark Lavonier. Mark also wrote and performed the theme music you're hearing right now. Support for Take Care comes from the Health Foundation for Western and Central New York. I'm Jason Smith.
And I'm Catherine Loper. We hope you'll join us again next time on Take Care.